Good evening. Kamala Harris shines as she schools Amy Coney Barrett, closing down peak power plants in New York, and the top Latino cop in New York City resigns. What's the story? With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI News for Wednesday, October 14th, 2020. The Senate Judiciary Committee is scheduled to vote to approve Judge Amy Coney Barrett's nomination to the Supreme Court before her confirmation hearings have even ended. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Lindsey Graham scheduled a committee meeting for 9 a.m. Thursday on the last day of the nomination hearings. Under committee rules, Barrett's nomination would be brought up for a vote and then delayed for a week. Meanwhile, on day three of the hearing, the Democratic nominee for vice president, Senator Kamala Harris, used her time to educate Barrett on the effect of Shelby versus Holder, a ruling that makes it more difficult to enforce the Voting Rights Act, effectively suppressing the rights of millions of voters.
North Carolina passed laws that made it so much more difficult for Black Americans to vote that a federal court of appeals mentioned that it, quote, targeted African Americans with almost surgical precision. Texas also has a long history of racial discrimination in voting and was therefore once also covered by the Voting Rights Act. But after Section 5 was gutted in Shelby, Texas quickly returned to some of its discriminatory voting practices. Of the more than 1,600 polling places closed after the court's decision, at least 750 were in Texas. Texas also restricted interpretation assistance for English-limited voters. And this year, the governor of Texas issued an order that limited the number of drop boxes for completed mail-in ballots to just one per county. Before the order, Harris County, Texas, which includes Houston, and had 11 ballot drop-off locations in a county of over 4 million residents and a county that covers about 2,000 square miles, many people would say that it is just common sense that going from 11 drop boxes to what it did, which is to reduce it to one single drop box, has made it more difficult for people to vote. The Supreme Court has long recognized that our right to vote is fundamental because it preserves and protects all other rights. No right is more precious in our democracy. Any nominee to the Supreme Court must understand the effect and the fact of ongoing efforts to discriminate against Black Americans, Latino Americans, Native Americans, students, and other communities of color. Since the Supreme Court's decision in Shelby, at least 23 states have passed restrictive voting laws and have attempted to also close polling places, stop early voting, and take people's names off the voter rolls that should not have been removed. So Judge Barrett, in Shelby County, Chief Justice Roberts wrote, voting, and quote, voting discrimination still exists. No one doubts that. And my question to you is, do you agree with Justice Roberts' statement?
Senator Harris, I want to just make sure that I understand that my understanding of what remains of the Voting Rights Act, what happened in Shelby County, is consistent with what you're describing. The preclearance requirement, as I understand Shelby County, remains in place, and what the Supreme Court held unconstitutional was the coverage formula. So some states, which in 1965 had a history of discrimination, had to get preclearance whenever they changed anything having to do with their voting procedures, and other states didn't. And I think Shelby County said that Congress can still pass a new coverage formula now, articulating the criteria for jurisdictions that are discriminating and requiring preclearance.
My question, however, is do you agree with Chief Justice Roberts, who said voting discrimination still exists? No one doubts that. Do you agree with that statement?
Senator Harris, I will not comment on what any justice said in opinion, whether an opinion is right or wrong, or endorse that proposition.
Well, I'm asking you, do you call it a proposition or a fact? Are you saying you do not agree with a fact?
Senator, I'm not going to make a comment. I'm not going to say that I endorse either the majority or the dissent in the case of Shelby County.
Well, I just want to understand, are you saying that you will, you refuse to dispute a known fact, or that you refuse to agree with a known fact?
Senator, I'm not exactly sure what you're getting at with asking me to endorse the fact or whether any particular practice constitutes voter discrimination. I'm very happy to say that I think racial discrimination still exists in the United States, and I think we've seen evidence of that this summer. But as
do you
to
think
engaging,
that voting discrimination exists, Senator, based on race in America in any form?
Senator Harris, there have been cases. We've talked in this hearing about the Wisconsin case that went up to the court involving voting. I think anything, any opinion that I would express, and I don't mean to signal that I disagree with the statement either. What I mean to say is I'm not going to express an opinion because these are very charged issues. They have been litigated in the courts, and so I will not engage on that question.
Amy Coney Barrett, answering questions from Kamala Harris at today's hearings. Harris then engaged Barrett on the issue of climate change.
And do you accept that COVID-19 is infectious?
I think, yes, I do accept that COVID-19 is infectious. That's something of which I feel like, you know, we could say you take judicial notice of. It's an obvious fact, yes.
Do you accept that smoking causes cancer?
I'm not sure exactly where you're going with this, but, you know, the notice that
it's
smoking
just
causes...
A question. The question is what it is. You can answer it if you believe yes or no.
Senator Harris, yes, every package of cigarettes warns that smoking causes cancer.
And do you believe that climate change is happening and it's threatening the air we breathe and the water we drink?
Senator, again, I was wondering where you were going with that. You have asked me a series of questions like that are completely uncontroversial, like whether COVID-19 is infectious, whether smoking causes cancer, and then trying to analogize that to eliciting an opinion on me that is a very contentious matter, opinion from me that is on a very contentious matter of public debate, and I will not do that. I will not express a view on a matter of public policy, especially one that is politically controversial, because that's inconsistent with the judicial role, as I have explained.
Thank you, Judge Barrett, and you've made your point clear that you believe it's a debatable point.
And Democratic Vice Presidential nominee Kamala Harris questioning Judge Amy Coney Barrett on day 3 of the Senate Judiciary hearing into her nomination to the Supreme Court. And First Lady Melania Trump said on Wednesday that the First Family's 14-year-old son, Barron, tested positive for COVID-19, but exhibited no symptoms after both of his parents contracted the virus. And top public health official Anthony Fauci said in an interview with CBS Evening News that President Trump is no longer capable of spreading a novel coronavirus and can attend a town hall on Thursday without putting others at risk. Trump revealed early on October 2nd that he had tested positive for the coronavirus. He said that he had recovered and was no longer contagious the following week. The town hall with NBC News is less than 3 weeks before the election, in which Republican Trump is trailing Democratic candidate Joe Biden in opinion polls. And the New York Power Authority, known as NYPA, and the PEAK Coalition, a group of 5 leading environmental justice and clean energy interests, unveiled an agreement today assessing how NYPA can close natural gas-fired peaker plants. Used to ensure there's enough power during peak electricity demand, the plants come on usually in the summer when air conditioning puts a strain on the electrical grid. Most of the fossil fuel peaker plants are among the oldest units still operating in New York City, some dating back to the 1950s and others built in the 1960s and 70s. The agreement will develop a plan to utilize clean energy technologies such as battery storage and low-to-zero carbon emission resources as part of a Vision Zero approach to eliminate carbon emissions by 2040. The executive director of the New York City Environmental Justice Alliance is Eddie Bautista.
The announcement was announcing this memorandum of understanding, an MOU that we signed a number of environmental justice groups with the New York Power Authority to embark on a study about what's a pathway to replace these gas-fired plants with renewable energy and storage. NYPA voluntarily agreed to the MOU, and to their credit, not only are they going to work with us to try to figure out a way to replace these, but they're actually going to be paying for our consultant, our technical consultant, so that we're able to have a conversation, a dialogue with them, and not be impeded by our lack of hyper-technical or hyper-engineering skills. They're going to actually pay for a consultant that will work with us as we negotiate a transition strategy with NYPA. There's no litigation. There's no legislation. There is one piece of legislation that passed last year that gave us new impetus to do this, and I believe is the reason why NYPA agreed to this process. Last year, we got passed something called the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. It is the most ambitious among the 50 states climate action plan. It basically mandates that New York State reach 85% emissions reduction, what they call 100% net zero emissions reduction economy-wide by 2050. It's big, it's ambitious, it's more aggressive than any other state's climate action plan. It's now actually served to influence the Biden energy plan as well as the Senate Democratic Climate Caucus. That change in the law, that mandate, emissions reduction mandate, which includes a provision that by 2040, all power plants have to be carbon free. That change in the law is a signal to all power plant operators, whether they're NYPA or private applicants, that if your power plant is running on fossil fuel, you're going to have to figure out a way to transition off that. You can only build them in certain zones, certain manufacturing. You can only build them when there's every manufacturing zone. That, by definition, limits the number of places you can build them because the city, over the years, has increasingly rezoned heavy manufacturing. Most of what's left of heavy manufacturing is in communities of color.
Right. So, like Hunt's Point.
One of the groups in this Peak Coalition is the Point on Garrison Avenue. They've been acting in Hunt's Point for at least 20 years, a range of environmental justice issues. So, yeah, two of these NYPA plants are in the South Bronx.
Basically, the idea is replace it with batteries.
Batteries plus renewable energy. So, you need both because right now, battery storage. I think that the maximum that it can store is like 8 hours. Although, again, mm-hmm. you know, the technology is improving like week to week. The technology is taking leaps and bounds. But at the moment right now, there isn't enough battery capacity alone to just handle it. So, yeah, it would be a mix of renewable energy plus. But again, these are the kinds of things that we're going to be doing the study about with NYPA, right? To try to figure out what's the battery capacity in 2020? What is it going to be like in 2024? There's a lot of kind of like heavy technical analysis that we have to do in terms of the state or the landscape of clean renewable energy and battery storage. At this moment, it appears it'll be a mix of renewable energy and battery storage, but that's what this study that we're going to embark on is going to hopefully clarify for all of us.
Right. I've seen there's a creative ideas.
Technology is like literally every year just scaling up, and the ability to get to meet the kind of growing energy demand that we have as society to be able to do that in a way that doesn't rely on fossil fuels. That's the big challenge for all of us, right? Like when people keep talking about climate change, that's, you know, one of the main drivers. Like, how do we meet our needs as a society while at the same time not destroying it in the process? Like, it's big, it's complicated, but there's been such progress over the last 10 to 15 years that we were hopeful that the next few years, those kind of improvements are going to make what we're proposing not just feasible, but economically and environmentally preferable. But that's, again, what we hope the study will uncover.
Eddie Bautista is executive director of the New York City Environmental Justice Alliance. He adds air pollution from peaker plants can worsen respiratory diseases like asthma and contribute to worse outcomes for COVID-19 patients. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. NYPD Chief of Patrol Fausto Pichardo reached a boiling point in his relationship with Mayor de Blasio this week. The story is that after working 36 hours covering protests against state-imposed coronavirus lockdowns in Borough Park, Pichardo missed a call from the mayor. The resulting mayoral meltdown was the last straw for the city's top Latino cop. Earlier today, Mayor de Blasio said it was all rumors, and Pichardo left for personal and family reasons.
One thing I needed to talk through with him, where I think there was some miscommunication, but he and I have talked dozens and dozens of times and had no problem communicating and working through things. Again, I understand the rumor mill, and I understand that people like to take small facts and exaggerate them into big stories. The bottom line here is he's making a personal decision. It is unusual, obviously, someone who, you know, had a very bright future ahead, but he's making a decision for family reasons. Someone doesn't make a decision of this magnitude unless there's something very big motivating it. And we talked, I'm not going to go into details about it, just to say we talked at length about what he was feeling about his personal needs, the things he needed to focus on, and I respect that. And that's obviously why I made the decision.
Chief Pichardo joins a long list of Latino officials who have left city government under de Blasio, including Catherine Garcia, the sanitation commissioner who left last month to possibly run for mayor, and Dr. Osiris Barbeau, who left after confronting cops who were grabbing hospital-bound PPE equipment, attracting the enmity of the mayor in the process. Bronx Borough President Ruben Diaz Jr. says Chief Pichardo was a friend and an excellent commander who knew the neighborhood.
Everyone knows that he is a Class A officer, a Class A public servant. I've known him. I've met him when he was the commanding officer of the 43rd Precinct, which is in the Bronx, which is the precinct that I live in. And this is the precinct where Amadou Diallo was shot and killed. And when we talk about trying to repair police-community relations, we were so elated when he got promoted to chief. Everyone in the NYPD will tell you that this is a guy who, not just because he's Latino, and I'll get to that in a minute, but he knows how to police, he knows how to make the community feel comfortable, he knows how to de-escalate things. And the fact that reports say that the mayor got petulant on him for not returning a call, maybe because he was tired. Look, Pichardo worked 36 straight hours trying to clean up the mayor's mess over there in Brooklyn. That's more hours, Paul, than the mayor works in an entire week. And it's not like he abandoned his post to be somewhere in Iowa. For those of us who are Latino and Latinx, we are really angry because when we know that we say Black Lives Matter, when we want better police community relations, we are also a part of that. And it seems like time and time again, whether it was with Nilda Irizarry Huffman, who was forced out, or now Pichardo, or others like De La Rosa who have been hidden in the NYPD, we believe that this mayor now does not give too much of a thought when it comes to Latinos in the city of New York. And that's not only when it comes to policing, but then look at Dr. Barbeau, who was doing an exemplary job in the city of New York around Corona, who was doing the best she could, who was trustworthy, and was given the best information, and he forced her out right in the middle of the pandemic.
Is this because of the police department? Is this because of outside forces? Or is this just a petulant mayor in the last 14 months of his reign who can do whatever he wants to because he's not facing re-election?
He's a petty. He's way in over his head. When he catches tantrums, he winds up turning off the most talented people in his administration time and time again. And it is sad. And now as a Latino and the Latinx community in the city of New York do not have adequate representation at the highest levels of the NYPD because of the mayor's sophomoric tensions.
The kettling incident that happened in the Bronx where activists were surrounded and then attacked and arrested before the curfew actually.
Oh, yeah.
And the Human Rights Watch had to get involved in that. It's not like, you know, the usual local groups, but somebody of international stature.
Was
that the police or the mayor?
Yeah, it was a little bit of both, where overzealous police officers out there, as well as them getting mixed messages from the mayor and from City Hall. During that protest, there wasn't, not a single bottle was thrown. There was no violence out there. People were executing and exercising their constitutional right to demonstrate and to protest. And they were doing it in a peaceful way. And what happened over there in the Mott Haven section of the Bronx is one of those instances where it didn't help. It just added fuel to the fire when no one was doing anything wrong other than voicing their frustration, their concerns, and their anger over not just what happened to George Floyd, but time and time again how these incidents happened to men of color, whether it was Anthony Byers in the mid-1990s, Amadou Diallo, Abner Louima, George Floyd in another state, and so on and so forth. What happened that day was a classic example of mixed messages from the NYPD and from City Hall, and it translated into, I believe, the violation of people's civil rights.
Could the COVID epidemic, the COVID pandemic of the last months have been handled better by a different mayor?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank goodness for Governor Cuomo.
Bronx Borough President Ruben Diaz Jr. Human Rights Watch released a report last month saying New York City police planned the assault and mass arrests of peaceful protesters in the Mott Haven neighborhood of the South Bronx on June 4th, 2020. The crackdown was among the most aggressive police responses to protests across the United States following the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, and could cost New York City taxpayers several million dollars in misconduct complaints and lawsuits. And while the Black Lives Matter movement has become an international symbol of racial solidarity in the face of countless atrocities against people of color, its progress is not just a result of outrage fueled by the murders of Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery. The movement's strength comes from the Black community's struggles for equity since the Middle Passage. The author of Black Fatigue, How Racism Erodes the Mind, Body, and Spirit, is Mary Frances Winters.
It impacts health. And I talk about that a lot in the book. There's new evidence and new science that says that the stress is passed down generationally. It gets into your cellular system, that there's some toxins. I'm not a doctor or anything. I'm a medical person. But the studies show that these toxins get into your system and they get passed down. And so that's why we find that there's disparity in health outcomes, even when you control for socioeconomics. And so socioeconomics don't make a difference relative to some of these outcomes. The worst part of it is living while Black and being fearful, and that again causes stress, that you or your loved one could leave home and not come back. And I have a son who is a professor at Duke University, a big, tall Black guy. He went to Harvard, Duke, and Princeton, but he's still a big, tall Black guy. And nobody knows that he went to Harvard, Duke, and Princeton. Not that that should matter in terms of how he's treated. However, I worry about him, and he's a grown man, and I worry about his safety. I worry about him driving while Black. I worry about him being mistaken for somebody else and all of those kinds of things.
We've had civil rights since the 1950s in Brown versus Board of Education till now. Black president. Has this had any effect to ameliorate these feelings?
I don't think so in totality, because one of the chapters in the book is called Then Is Now. And so you mentioned Brown versus Board of Education. So our schools are more segregated today than they were when Brown versus Board of Education was passed and made it illegal for segregated schools and public education. So that hasn't changed. When we look at socioeconomics, the net worth of white people is 10 times that of Black people. And that's been the case since the 60s. That hasn't changed. In the big picture, we've made progress. I think obviously there are individuals, you know, you can point to, yes, well, we elected a Black president, we have Black persons on the Supreme Court, and you know, you could name these, you know, one or two people who have made it through. But when you look at it in the aggregate, no, we have not made progress.
There was actually a TikTok video I saw, and it was a white kid who, one of his parents was African American, and he had many, many cousins and other relatives who were Black, and he could speak as family to, and he would say, how do you know, to the Black people, how do you know when somebody's a racist or not? And they laughed, and he said in this TikTok video, which I thought was telling, if they're from a red state, they're always racist, and if they're from a blue state, if they're old, they're racist, if they're young, they're not.
Some theorists say that because we live in a racialized world, where there is a racial hierarchy that we cannot get around, that in some ways we are all racist. And because there's something called internalized racism, and that is when people of color begin to believe the negative stereotypes about themselves. That's internalized racism. So the idea of racism is basically that there's a racial hierarchy, and that there are some groups that are closer to white and anything closer to white that gets advantages that people who are darker do not. It's a global phenomenon. Colorism is a global phenomenon. In my book, I talk about the fact that light-skinned Black men get paid more than dark-skinned Black men for the same job. Light-skinned Latinos get paid more than dark-skinned Latinos for the same job. So there are lots of studies that show that this internalized, as you said earlier, some of it is just unconscious. It's just the way that it is. But I think that when we think about it, you know, really, it really is in our DNA. I mean, that's how we have been socialized. It's intra as well. Years ago, it used to be the brown paper bag test. And within the Black community, if you were darker than a brown paper bag, then you couldn't get into certain organizations and certain groups.
What's the way out? Or is there a way out? Or we just have to adapt to this reality?
I absolutely think that there's a way out. I think we have to look at our structures. I think we have to look at the powers that be. People in power, I call them the power brokers in the book. We have allies. Allies are not necessarily power brokers, right? They're not necessarily in power. Those people who are in power can change systems. They can change the rules. For example, inequities in pay. You look at your data, you look at the inequities in pay, and you fix it. from a gender perspective that there's still inequities in pay. There shouldn't be. When you have data that shows you what those inequities are, those in power, fix it.
Anything like to add?
Read Black Fatigue, www.wintersgroup.com is where you can find it.
And that's the author of Black Fatigue, How Racism Erodes the Mind, Body, and Spirit, Mary Frances Winters. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, October 14th, 2020.